This podcast is presented to you by a new series, the Clergy Confessions Podcast, now available wherever you get your podcast. Listen to ministers share truly awful experiences in anonymity. In this first season, you will hear stories of a minister fighting for maternity leave deep into her pregnancy, a pastor being fired for discovering an embezzlement scheme by the deacon board, an associate pastor finding his senior pastor and office administrator having an affair on church property, and so much more. Visit clergyconfessions.com. Follow Clergy Confessions on Instagram, Facebook, and whatever Twitter's called now.
You illustrate these moments in history as examples of the walk by in the Good Samaritan, and the same mindset that wreaked havoc on the indigenous populations carried with it systemic racism that continues to this day. The reason of understanding these historical and social frameworks is important because it directly connects to our attitude towards public health issues and those most affected by it, right?
Welcome to the CBF Podcast Conversation. We know that conversations matter, so each week we are grinding through the critical research to bring you the best stories and resources of people doing groundbreaking and innovative work in renewing God's world. I'm Andy Hale, your CBF podcast host, and this year we're celebrating our 7th year of the podcast, bringing you even better interviews worth your time, attention, and collaboration. These episodes are not intended for you to listen to an island unto yourself. Get online, share your insights, thoughts, and feedback from the podcast with us on CBF's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages. We also want you to join the CBF podcast community through our CBF podcast listener support page at cbf.net/podcast support. We see you, Pasadena, California, Louisville, Kentucky, Beaverton, Oregon, and Frankfurt, Germany. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. We want to give a special shout out to some of our listener supporters.
The Honorable Charles Qual, Caroline Bell, Cindy Foldenlohr, Trip Hawthorne, Bill Johnson, Carson Fushi, Ralph Stocks, and that generous anonymous donor that keeps giving in honor of CBF Grump. Thanks for listening, Little Rock, Arkansas, Pittsburgh, PA, Ashburn, Virginia, West Yellowstone, Montana, Tamworth, Australia, and Hamilton, Canada. First-time listeners and long-time listeners, we are grateful you are here for the conversation. And before we move on, we need to give a word of gratitude to our annual sponsors, including Zondervan Media Company,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
a model ministry,
and Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity. Finally, and I promise this is it, don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms.
We need to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity.
The Gardner-Webb University School of Divinity aims to equip, nurture, encourage, and support men and women for their best service in the kingdom of God. Offering several programs, including master's and doctoral levels, you'll be equipped and encouraged to discover the unique place where your faith reaches out to meet the needs of the world. Now enrolling for fall of 2023, for more information about Gardner-Webb Divinity programs, scholarships, and grants, call 704-406-3205 and visit gardner-webb.edu.
Our guest for this week's CBF podcast conversation is Dr. Emily Smith. She is a professor at Duke University's Emergency Medicine and at the Duke Global Health Institute. She's also the creator of the Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist Facebook page and Substack. Emily, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So I imagine in the last several years, people have been asking you a lot of questions. I wonder why that is.
Oh, sure. Well, before the pandemic, people didn't know what epidemiology was. I think they thought we were like skin doctors, like epidermis or entomology, with bugs. But yeah, and then all of a sudden, when the pandemic hit, we were the people that, this is our lane for sure.
Yeah. So we're going to dive into the book, and so much of the book is memoir based in a sense, but we won't cover that later on in the conversation. So I'd love to talk about now. It's like, how does one want to get into this, all the things, what was it that inspired you to want to get into this field?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's, it is not one that like is like law or medicine, you know, where people just hear about from a very young age. I grew up in the church. My parents were worship leaders at a charismatic church. And so we always hosted a lot of missionary families. And I just remember from a really young age asking them probably too many questions, bless them. And I don't remember them getting frustrated with my 8-year-old multiple of questions, but I was just enamored with the world and helping people. I just wanted to do it. So I thought the only way that you could do that was medical school and helping people. And so I was pre-med. I went to Wayland Baptist University in the Panhandle of Texas, itty bitty, great university. I shouldn't say itty bitty because it's not super small, but most people don't know where Plainview is. But I was pre-med there and met my husband at the time. And we got, when we got married, right after we graduated, his first job was across the country in South Carolina. So I had a gap year between when I was going to go to medical school. And so I decided what every good nerd does is just get another degree. So I enrolled and got my MPH degree in public health with a concentration in epidemiology. And I didn't quite know what it was at the time. I just knew it involved a lot of statistics and math and data. I was just a big science nerd. So I chose it. And then in day one of Epi, the professor, who was just incredibly engaging anyways, he started saying, you know, epidemiology is the science of how a disease spreads and who is most at risk of it so that we can actually do something about it. And something just clicked in my head that day that, oh, this is the science of the Good Samaritan for me. You know, it just fit naturally to me. It's like the science of quantifying who is most at risk and choosing not to walk by. So it felt like it was a fit. And, you know, the year before I got the master's, when I was still on the pre-med track, I went on my first missions trip to the Mercy Ship in Honduras. And instead of asking more of like the one-on-one questions of, you know, how do you treat this person? I found myself asking more of the bigger questions of why is poverty so big in this region and not in others? Or why did families wait so long to come to get care than others did? What about the topography of the land? And those are epidemiology questions. You know, it's community, it's population based. So I didn't know it at the time, but I was thinking like that anyways. And then I fell into it with the gap year.
I do want to go back to one thing from earlier, and it's totally unrelated to what you discussed, which is Plainview, Texas is a beautiful part of Texas. I've been to that part of Texas before. And I think, you know, a lot of people that think of Texas, which it takes like 3 days to drive across.
Sure.
Plainview is right there in the sweet spot of getting to see like upper New Mexico and Colorado and Utah and all those really cool places are like short driving distance. So,
yes, I mean, I love it too. I miss being able to see the sun set and rise and you see the whole thing. So I do miss that part of the land.
So one more question, then we'll get to the book. You know, obviously kind of the pandemic cultivated this opportunity for you to be able to write about what people are experiencing, which is, you know, you developed this Friendly Neighborhood Epidemiologist Facebook page. Tell us what that experience was like starting that during the pandemic.
Yeah, for sure. And it's actually Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist, not Neighborhood. There is another... That's okay. No problem. There's another one and she's lovely. The Friendly Neighborhood. She's great, but we would get mixed up all the time. So Friendly Neighbor. So, you know, I remember I was speaking at two events right when Wuhan was just starting to happen. And a lot of us epidemiologists or public health people, we had been trained in looking on the horizon for scary pandemics that could happen, or, you know, you go through these scenarios in school. So when Wuhan started happening, it caught a lot of our attention because we knew it was going to be different than something like Ebola. And Ebola is awful and horrific, but you know, when you're sick with that most of the time, because you're just so sick and you know, when you're contagious, what we were seeing in Wuhan is you were probably contagious before you knew you were sick. And so it was much, much easier to spread. So I remember being at those events and people were just asking, you know, should we basically be scared of this or what do we need to do? And then when I got back home, you know, we all remember it just moved very quickly. People were asking the questions of what does flatten the curve mean? Do we need to pull our kids, you know, from school forever? Just these really big questions. What about toilet paper? Do I need to buy way too much of that? And so I decided, why not just start a Facebook page to help my real life neighbors and family? So I named it Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist, because I tend to be too friendly at times, and that is okay. I'm leaning into it. And then neighbor, because something like COVID, I knew was going to be a pandemic that it would rely on us as neighbors taking care of one another. My day job is also working in really, really poverty-stricken areas around the world and with children and families. So I knew that if a pandemic hit in those areas as well, which it likely would, they would depend on people that could, you know, get to healthcare access or get vaccines or whatever. So we needed to be good neighbors. So I named it Neighbor because of that. I also, you know, at the time was mainly speaking to a Christian faith audience. And I'm talking like 50 people on the page, not a lot. But I thought this would be the time for the church to really neighbor one another well. That Good Samaritan story, you know, the science of the Good Samaritan, I think, is epidemiology. So that neighbor seemed to fit. And then it just kind of grew slowly at the beginning until the pandemic started getting these weird overtones of Christian nationalism. And when I would say you use the word like equity, there were a group of people who just got very angry. So, of course, they would share that and then other people would get angry. But it just grew and grew and grew. And then George Floyd was murdered, and I talked about that. I talked about systemic racism that we were seeing with lack of vaccines or testing sites, global and local. And then when January 6th happened, you know, the riots, I wrote this post about the messy thread of faith and nationalism and racism. And I was just kind of letting it all out there. And that one really went viral. So it grew to, you know, a reach of about 10 million people over the pandemic, which was certainly more than just my family and friends.
We can't go any further without telling about one of our annual sponsors, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky. How does your congregation handle ministry staff leadership for areas such as youth and children's ministry? More and more churches are cultivating these leaders from within their congregations. Going away to seminary is not an option for these persons, yet many desire some level of theological education to better prepare them for their ministry role. In response to this trend, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky has launched the Homegrown Initiative. The Homegrown Initiative offers ministry leaders options for training and growth that fits into their busy schedules. If you or someone else at your church is serving as a homegrown minister and is looking to be better equipped as a minister, visit bsk.edu to learn more about new creative options for growth. bsk.edu. That's bsk.edu.
I think I'm realizing that despite the fact that I actually have in my notes neighbor, it's because as a child reading the Amazing Spider-Man comics, he was the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Oh, sure.
And it just, you know, naturally
kind of
flows with it.
Tongue.
Yeah,
yes.
Rolls off the tongue. Yeah. So let's jump into the new book, The Science of the Good Samaritan. This book invites readers to broaden their understanding of what it means to love neighbor. You've taken a story that everyone across the world knows, but one that continues to challenge us with nuanced complexities. So walk us through how it inspires your work and ultimately this book.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think a lot of people are familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan, Christian or not. And it, you know, it's a story that we've all likely read for a very long time. If you've grown up in a Christian church, you definitely have. But I had missed some of the nuances of it until I read it again during the pandemic. And there's this man who approaches Jesus and basically says, who is my neighbor? And to me, it depends on posturing of how he asked that. But I wonder it sounds like a question of what is good enough to be a neighbor? How much do I need to give? Is 10% tithe fine? Can I just donate money at Thanksgiving? Can I sponsor one child? What is good enough to be good enough? And instead of answering him, Jesus does his normal, you know, flip the script type, either ask a question or tell a story. And he told a story of a man who was on the side of the road and was very hurt, and two people walk by. And, you know, I pay attention to what Jesus said in that story and what he didn't say. Those two that walked by, to me, depict people of power, people of privilege, you know, the religious leaders of the day, until finally a Samaritan stops. And there's a whole book on the beauty of that, being a Samaritan. But when he stopped and helped the man. And not only that, he like bandaged him up, took him to a place to recover, and paid for it. And I had missed that. So Jesus tells that story. And then he looks back at the man and says, instead of, you know, who is the neighbor, or who is my neighbor? He said, who was the neighbor? Like, it's an action item. And so to me, those represent two different postures, centering of our lives, you know, what is good enough to good enough versus just living a life of neighboring. And the book is largely on how do you become a person of neighboring, just like the Samaritan did intrinsically. It's like he didn't even think about it. He just neighbored.
You know, we'll get to the meat of the book here in a second, but this book is equal parts insight into epidemiology, into theological interpretation of current context, and personal memoir. Why was it important to convey your journey as part of this literary journey?
Oh, that's a great question. I haven't been asked that yet, and I love that. I mean, I think there's power in storytelling, and in particular our stories, and I think it helps us at least be neighbor and be friends to people when you tell that story. So I just wanted to tell, you know, part of my growing up, or how I saw the world, or how other people I had met saw the world too, because I just think it's powerful. I also didn't want this book to just be boring textbook, you know, like science class, which I think is lovely, but I don't think everybody else feels that way, or I know they don't. So I just wanted to make it accessible to people just like me. I mean, I'm a mom of two, as normal as could be.
You know, in reading the book, I was pleasantly surprised at the number of issues that you address that first appear outside of the field of epidemiology. But you argue that this is what epidemiology is, measuring the problem correctly so we can do something about it. Walk mm-hmm. us through why an epidemiologist needs to address things like poverty and systemic racism and issues of equity and so forth.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's, you know, we implement what we measure, or we implement on what we measure. And by we, I mean, you know, the United Nations and big governing boards, even church. So if the problem is defined wrong or not defined at all, we're going to implement on the wrong thing. And so I want to get that question right. You know, what is the true story of people living in poverty? And to give you an example, you know, my day job is here at the Duke Global Health Institute, and we work in places like Somaliland and Burundi, extremely poor countries. And we know that there's a lot of children there that need healthcare, you know, either for cancer or surgery or something that will really impoverish families, but we don't know where they are in the country. So the data helps us find that. And then you go further into that data and you can find the families who are the most at risk. So it's like getting to the margins of the margin of the margins with the data so that we can actually do something about it.
There's a quote from the book. There's a long and fraught history of how empire, religion, and health are linked. But the more truthful way to say it is that white privilege, or Western privilege, has been used for religious conquest and land and power grabbing, and sometimes both in the name of God. The results often carried health consequences, without the power of oppression and conquering. Obviously, you can teach an entire course on this subject, but briefly walk us through some of the ways that disease has been weaponized for conquest and subjugation.
Yeah, that's a great question too. You know, I wrote The first section has a lot of history, because I think that history still informs the present, but a lot of people, especially in the American church, don't know that. So to give an example, I tell this story about in 1885, there were 14 countries that were represented all by, they were all high income countries, so the white men around it. And at the back of the room, there was this huge map of Africa. This is called the Great Scramble, if you've heard about it. But on their opening document is "In the name of God Almighty." And basically what they did around that table was decide what part of the African continent they could basically colonize, which part is whose. And so they spliced and diced the continent just based on arbitrary. Two of the men had actually been to the continent, and none of the rest have or had at the time. And no one from Africa was actually there. The Sultan of Zanzibar asked to come and was not given access. So at the end of that, it actually cut up 10% of the traditional ethnic, religious lines, you know, the people and community groups that were already there of no fault of their own. Then you see the colonizers come in some horrific atrocities that happen. If you just look at King Leopold of in Belgium with the Congo, I mean, just horrific things. When you look at where I work in Somalia, Somalia and Somaliland, Italy, when they colonized their country, it has some significant repercussions. And that, if you fast forward 100 years, is still going on. So the places in the continent that have the highest rates of poverty and instability and civil unrest are the places that were spliced and diced unnaturally or colonized with the brutality like I just talked about with Belgium. And, you know, I think it's important for us to recognize that, because modern day, we could say it's just the health of the children are really bad in these countries. But if you trace that lineage back 100 plus years, there are some reasons why that if we can take that into account, I think it helps us be better neighbors. I also think it helps us not shame countries or people for being poor or having low access to healthcare or water or whatever you want to call it. Most of the time, it is of no fault of their own. And when we realize that history, without getting so defensive, I say we is like the American church, I think it helps us understand and not shame. And hopefully it moves us to do something about it. You know, more closer to home here in Durham, I write about redlining. And if you go back in the 50s and 60s, there were neighborhoods that were predominantly Black that were redlined and not given home loans strictly because it was predominantly Black neighborhood. You can actually go into the reasons why they weren't given homes. And it's pretty egregious. It is just pretty awful at what was said. Well, fast forward to nowadays, and those neighborhoods are about $40,000 to $50,000 to $60,000 lower in home equity than in white neighborhoods with the same square footage, you know, same walkability or trees or access to playgrounds. So I think it helps us be better neighbors globally and locally to know that and not shame people.
We are pausing to tell you about one of our collaborative annual sponsors, A Model Ministry. Are you a church leader who's committed to keeping children safe? If so, then A Model Ministry is for you. We are a registered nonprofit organization specializing in safety education, policy writing, and risk assessment to mitigate child abuse in ministry organizations. We understand that child safety is a top priority for churches, and we are here to create a safe and nurturing environment for all children. Our founders can provide the resources and support needed to implement effective child safety policies and procedures. Visit amodelministry.com to learn more about our services and how we can help keep children safe.
Since 2016, CBF episodes of interviews with authors and practitioners for conversations that matter. These stories of creativity and innovation have garnered weekly support from around the United States and the world. We are inviting you, the listeners, to join us in connecting with the podcast. Become a monthly listener supporter and receive some perks, including name recognition on the podcast, questions for upcoming guests, free books from the podcast, joining the podcast for an interview, and a VIP experience with the General Assembly podcast guest. There are five levels of listener support, starting at $5 per month. for less than the cost of a pumpkin spice latte, you will be featured by name on the weekly podcast episode. For more information and to join the community of listener supporters, visit cbf.net/podcast support.
You illustrate these moments in history as examples of the walk-by in the Good Samaritan and the same mindset that wreaked havoc on the indigenous populations carried with it systemic racism that continues to this day. You know, the reason of understanding these historical and social frameworks is important because it directly connects to our attitude towards public health issues and those most affected by it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think when we understand that better, I think it can, well, it just gets back to the issue of shaming, of not shaming people for whatever situation that they're in. I mean, I'm sure that everybody has heard someone shame someone who is homeless or without a job. You just need to get a job. And that is a lot harder. What about generational wealth? And when we think about that, so I think especially when the white church can see that, it just helps us see the reality of the world and history. And, you know, I also wanted to write it to help people understand you don't have to be so defensive. To give you an example, I write about my own grandparents, the lovely hardworking Dust Bowl, you know, built a farm and worked on a railroad and built a great farm and a life. And I'm still a product and living of that, or living, you know, off of that. But at the same time, they were white and they were able to get loans or farm loans or land if they wanted to. And that's not the case for everybody. So there's a generational wealth aspect, I think, to how we understand poverty. Or wealth building and capitalism.
What always perplexed me during the height of the pandemic was the politicalization of it all. The same wave of people who argued Americans to display flags in solidarity after 9/11 became the same people who resisted masks and social distancing and isolation. You shared that the open hostility you received as a global health expert, writing, more than 90% of the threats I received were from people of faith. When you actually know them and they go to church with you, it really throws you off kilter. I'm not ready to talk about everything that happened during that time. It was traumatizing. It was awful. It was costly. I wonder if you'll take us a little deeper, not into the specifics of your experience, but just kind of the overall experience and how maybe you were surprised by the pushback from that particular religious sect, if you will.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I was completely taken aback by it. And when I started being a little bit more vocal on how we should have faith over fear, and that includes wearing a mask, you know, that was in response to people using the faith over fear as a, well, we just need to trust God and not wear a mask. And I just could not understand where that was coming from, especially because wearing a mask and vaccines when they came out were part of loving our neighbors. And so I started getting some feedback, and of course, anybody on the internet can say what, you know, what they want, if they should or shouldn't. And it's scary to get pictures of guns or threats from, you know, people you don't know. But then when we started getting things at the house or from people that I just knew in my own town or community, it was really scary. And it was scary and very unstabilizing. Because it felt like a foundation of, you know, 40 years of faith or listening to, you know, Christian singers that I knew were going to do something that was not right at the pandemic. It felt like losing that part of the foundation. And I think a lot of people felt that. I know pastors did, I know that they struggled a lot, you know, during the pandemic of what to do. So I was trying to come alongside them and help them shepherd the congregation from a point of data, but I was completely taken aback with that response just from people I knew, pastors I knew.
You know, I know you've written an entire book to address this, but why do you think people of faith, especially many white evangelical Christians, were adversarial to pandemic protocols?
Gosh, that's a great question. And I think in 10 years, everybody's going to be doing a dissertation about it, who's in getting their PhD. So we'll probably know better than what I think. But I wonder, some of it is, you know, the American church, especially evangelicals, we're so individualistic. And so neighboring and taking care of people is not necessarily intrinsic to who we are from the get-go. It's very much capitalism, very much entrepreneur, growth, growth, growth. So I wonder if that might have been some of it. You know, we were asked to do something for the sake of our neighbors that would be a little inconvenient for a time, but it would protect the most vulnerable in terms of health conditions and poverty. And I just don't think that a lot of people were attuned to that already. That might have been some of it. I also think that politics matter. And I talked a little bit about this in the book, but the book is not a book about COVID because I just can't talk about it for 200 pages. It's also not a book about politics, but I do give a nod to both of those aspects because leadership matters and how we talk about public health and the discourse around it. It just matters. So I think that was part of it too. And there is one chapter where I talk about the, there was this hearkening back in the church to the good old days and thinking that the good old days were actually good old days, which it was if you were white and well off, not if you were anything else. So I don't think people recognize that and they're just looking for control. That's my first stab at it. I'm not quite sure if I got that right, but that's what I'm wondering about.
Well, I think it's a building thing, right? It's not just about COVID, but what how people responded to COVID, how that really does truly personify what you're conveying in this book. And at the root of our inability or ability to love our neighbor is our aptitude to see the sacredness in others and to look beyond ourselves and what affects our neighbor. You wrote, "We don't always recognize the sacred in others. At least I don't. Do you know the scripture that says when we feed the hungry, clothe the needy, tend to the sick, and visit the prisoner or widow, we actually do these things for Jesus?" The reality across the world, Christians have a corner market on compassion ministries. I mean, we're known for our missions. But I wonder, why do you think American Christians have a limited scope of the modern nuances behind Jesus' invitation to feed the hungry, to clothe the needy, to tend to the sick, and so on?
Yeah, that's a good, I think it's because we're not up close and personal to it near as much as other countries, maybe even other neighborhoods. You know, I think when we are walking with beside somebody who is a friend and you notice they don't have shoes on, or maybe you don't have shoes on, it's instinctive to say, "Oh, well, let me help you," or, you know, "Let me carry the load a little bit." If you're not friends and actually walking side by side in a way that is not hierarchy or paternalistic, but just actually side by side them, I think that you can recognize the sacred in the other. But I think it's very hard in a sheltered American life to see the reality of the rest of the world correctly like Jesus did. And, you know, I wanted the first of the book, the book has three sections, centering cost and courage, because I'm a good pastor's wife. And so it had to have 3 points. But that centering section is on how do we get our heart to center correctly like Jesus did. And when we see him in the Bible, he is centering children in the middle of everybody. He's centering, he stops crowds with bleeding and impoverished women. He centers lepers and people that are untouchable at the time. And, you know, even in his opening sermon that he ever gave, he centered the poor and the oppressed and the captive. So I think we've got our centering wrong in the American church. What I don't want to be is someone who just gives money once a year or like a good person. I want to do that. And also, you'll hear that a lot in the book, have a heart where I will instinctively stop on the side of the road for you know, whatever problem it is. But I think it's hard for people to center correctly when they don't see it or aren't aware of it.
We like to think that we've moved beyond the siloed nature of our cultural and racial homogeneity. But the reality is we rarely cross paths and interact with those who live differently than we do in faith and cultural expression and ethics and race and more. You argue that accompanying others creates a higher capacity for us to notice, to act, and to give. How do we practically do this in light of our, like I said before, our homogeny in our daily lives?
Yeah. And I don't give a ton of practical tools in here because it's more to me about the heart. But I think some things that we can do right now is learn the history of a place or a problem better. Learning something even like pulse oximeters. I don't know if you had one of those. It's the thing that you put on the tip of your finger during COVID, if you get COVID, and it measures your oxygen level. And when those were created, they were created by and calibrated to white people. And so people with darker skin will actually get an accurate rating. And that affects whether or not you get certain medications. I mean, it definitely affects how sick somebody can get. I think it's important to know that, or important to know about the Great Scramble, or it's incredibly important to just listen. I think hearing people's stories, someone like Esau Macaulay just put out, you probably read it, that incredibly great book and hard to read book on his own story and his family. I think it's reading and it's listening more than we're talking. If you really want to get practical, there is I did 4 tips at the end of the book, especially for families in the church. If you're raising kiddos, here's what I did with mine. That includes, you know, getting a map of places and putting it on the fridge, getting some post-it notes and learning a different language. And so I think the younger we can instill that type of neighboring even into our children, and a map is powerful to do that, I think it can just help for that new generation.
You obviously, you know, expressed in the book and expressed in our conversation and just the combative nature of our culture right now. It's so divided. There are these very real lines in the sand, and coming together seems very difficult. You wrote, "Dismantling walls of hostility is hard work and might require you to change friends and communities. It will definitely require humble soul searching and empathetic listening. Real peace also takes a long time." I wonder if you'll take us a little deeper there.
Yes. And that was really written into response of when I would hear, "We just all need to get along," or "We need to come together." And I understand the sentiment of that, because I agree with that, yes. But there is an underlying assumption that when we come together, or we all just need to get along, that typically means there's two sides and both sides are weighted equally. And we know historically that has not been the case. So I think we need to make sure that whatever we're coming together on is actually the true center, instead of a bias center of a political ideology that doesn't look like Jesus at all. I also, the getting along is not the goal, is that chapter that you read that from. I think the goal is true justice and true peace, which means it will be uncomfortable for a while. You know, in the churches that I've been in, there is such a want for peace. And I just, yes to all of that. But if that peace is only for one group and not for the rest of the world or all, that's not true peace. It's just like a little bubble that probably feels good. So how do we get to the peace that actually is what we see at the cross, you know, where it's just level, there's level ground there for all? And I think the way to do that is we have to shake the current systems a little bit, like what you talked about with systemic racism, or just understanding bigotry and calling that out is shaking the existing structure so that it will actually reflect heaven. And that is really hard work to do in the church when people are so kind of stuck in their ways. That's another reason why I wanted to make the book a little bit more conversational and story, because I'm hoping it can be something that churches can do and, you know, in Bible studies or book clubs or something together. And it almost takes the scariness away of the big words like structural violence or equity. You know, how do we understand that in a way where maybe there's a conversation around it?
Let's take a break to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work. What is social work? At Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work, it's empowerment, service, and justice. It's ministry, counseling, and relationship building. It's faith, practice, and community. But above all, it's learning how to help others thrive. Social workers can be found addressing the full scope of the human experience at churches, schools, prisons, government agencies, senior living centers, nonprofits, and Fortune 500 companies. Careers in social work profession are vast and varied. What is social work, you ask? It's much more than you think. Visit gsswstories.baylor.edu to explore more. Deep background kind of in philosophy and religion and world religions. And of course, you can't avoid Greek mythology when it comes to all that. And I'm reminded of the story of Sisyphus, who is in the afterlife tasked with pushing this gigantic boulder to the top of the hill. And right before he reaches the apex of it, it just rolls back down. And so much of the work of seeking justice in our world can feel like that. And you wrote, all the injustices are important to combat, but of course the battles are too much for just one person. We each have to choose wisely because we cannot carry the weight of all of them, not even a few of them. And not all the battles or issues or arguments are ours to jump into and fight anyways. The real question for us then is this: what is my good work that I cannot and will not come down for? So in thinking through so much of what you've conveyed in this book, how do we not become the Sisyphus when it comes to combating injustices in our community?
Yes. And that was written, that chapter in particular was written to a response to what, to my experience, you know, with getting the type of backlash that I was getting in my family and children were getting about speaking out of about the pandemic. About 15 months into it, my body just said no more. And it just broke down for a good 15 months with debilitating headaches, migraines that just would not go away. And so I had a lot of time to reflect on, gosh, where could I have caught myself, or what could I have done differently to not be here? Because it was horrible, and I'm still getting over that. So that I remembered the story about Nehemiah, you know, he's just a cupbearer for the king, and then he decides to go and do this huge work and harness the enthusiasm of the people. So he's building the wall, and these people, Sanballat and Tobias, come, and basically they tried to distract him by, a lot of people are talking bad about you. Why don't you, let's go revenge yourself, basically avenge. And he doesn't take the bait. He says, no, I'm not going to do it. But then they come later with a sneak attack. And I know there's a lot of pastors listening, so I'm sorry about the liberty I took with the sneak attack. It is not verbatim NIV. But they said things like, why don't you just come down for coffee and we'll just hang out and talk a little bit about what you're doing. I mean, it was really subtle. And he said the most incredible thing. He said, I'm doing a great work and I'm not going to come down. And to me, that has been such an anchor to know what is my lane and what isn't. To give you an example of very specific of what that meant to me, I was speaking out a lot about Christian nationalism, which is all wonderful and good. But at the same time, I was speaking on global vaccine inequities and global children's health, which is my job. And I had this moment where I realized I can't do it all. And I almost have to choose, because there's only so much that I have the strength to do physically, well, and emotionally. And so I chose to do the global work more than speaking out as much about the Christian nationalism. And I think that's okay. I think that knowing what my good work is and choosing not to come down for something that we need to tackle, like Christian nationalism, but also just for things that get us distracted, like a Facebook comment or a friend who says something, you know, that can just get in our bones. And I think when we have the wisdom to choose and to know the difference between those, we can actually do our good work and not come down. And I say that a lot to people in the church, because usually we are people of empathy, and most of us have a lot of compassion. And if we're not careful, you start hearing about global children's health, like what I do. And then you hear about climate change, and then you hear about poverty, and then there's racism. And it can get overwhelming to a point where you can say, well, I just can't tackle it all, so I might not try anything. I think the wisdom of Nehemiah is to know out of those, what can I do? And what can others do? And I will encourage them to do it. I think that's part of the beauty of the church too, is you've got all, hopefully, all in there with these, with their own lanes and their own portion of whatever they're building.
Lastly, you are ultimately inviting people to a new table. You are just to see that there is a table where deeds meet faith, where there's enough seats for all, and then some, one that interrupts us and shows us the way of Jesus. How have you experienced this in your journey?
Wow, that's a great question. The picture of a table, I've always loved. I just believe in community and asking people over, you know, just spending hours around a table. But then, being a woman in science, I noticed that those tables, typically there's not someone who looks like me. If you look at tables of power, I went to the United Nations to talk about poverty. It is typically still like that horseshoe table, you know, high income countries. So it feels like the tables are, there's only so many seats. They're tables of scarcity and of power and of privilege. But what we see with Jesus is it's just this long extended table that is welcoming for all, has enough room and food for all, even if he has to multiply whatever we have, like the bread and loaves and fish stories. But I think that looks like heaven too. You know, we see pictures of in Revelation of the description of heaven where all the nations, and you just get these all type of stories. That means there's enough room, and there's some abundance too that I think Jesus talked about, even with abundant life. So the table for me is, how can we be people, the Big C Church, who either shake existing tables that aren't equal or just go build a new one? And I think building a new one is a lot better when you have people around you to do that. And I found that during the pandemic, it was largely, this book is in response to people who were asking, I never heard about systemic racism or unequal tables or all of these discussions, but I see it now, and I don't want to be a person who walks by. So I think when we hold up those hard topics like systemic racism or poverty or equity to the sky, I actually think it's going to reflect heaven when we tackle it. And I think that's through the picture of a table.
So this book is very practical. You know, and obviously congregations can pick it up and use it now. What other resources are you wanting to produce to help local congregations?
Yes, we are about to release and post a study guide that goes with the book so that churches can use it either as a book club or maybe a Bible study or a Wednesday night thing. And I give a lot of space for just discussion for people to tell their stories, but I also give a couple of, you know, here's what I would ask as a question for these couple of chapters, and here's some discussion things to take home with you. If it is in a Christian faith space, there's also a section to guide where to go in the Bible to look for some verses that are relevant to that chapter. And I put those at the end of the study guide, so any place of worship can really use this.
Our guest is Dr. Emily Smith. The book is The Science of the Good Samaritan. You can follow her work at Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist on Facebook and Substack. Emily, it's been a joy meeting with you. Thank you for challenging us to come to a new table where deeds meet faith, our way of living is interrupted to reflect Jesus.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
We are grateful for a chance to pause to tell you about one of our annual sponsors, Zondervan Media Group.
Explore the depth and beauty of Scripture with the NRSV Updated Edition. With provisions based on new contextual evidence, historical insights, and linguistic precision, this updated edition of the NRSV delivers a translation of Scripture based on meticulous care for accuracy and readability. Learn more about new editions of the NRSV UE from Zondervan at nrsvuebible.com.
Okay, that's it. That's our conversation. If you want more, be sure to subscribe to CBF on all major platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Google Podcast. Don't forget to like and share this episode on your favorite social media platforms. Be sure to support our annual sponsors by visiting their websites. Again, that's Gardner Webb University School of Divinity, a model ministry, Baptist Seminary of Kentucky,
Baylor University's Garland School of Social Work,
and Zondervan Media Company. Check out more at cbf.net for more information about church starters, field personnel, advocacy work, and more. And I'm not sure if we mentioned that you should join the listener support community at cbf.net/podcast support.